Hey listeners, Movie Miss here, wanting to thank you so much for joining us for this Unlocked Patreon episode in honor of April 1st or April Fool's Day. I thought this would be a great time to roll out and unlock our April Fool's Day the movie episode from season one, which was myself and my co-host at the time, Miss Nikki Flicks. If you like what you hear, over on our Patreon is over 100 hours of content over on the Patreon for the $3 a month tier. You can get all of Nikki Flicks episodes, season 1, 2, all of it. So that is over on patreon.com/letstalkturkeys. You also get Patreon exclusive episodes just for subscribers. And as always, thank you so much for listening here on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And now, please enjoy this unlocked episode, April Fool's Day.
Baby, you are gonna go broke showing turkeys like these.
It's turkey time. Gobble, gobble.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Let's Talk Turkeys. Today, we're talking 1986, April Fool's Day. I'm Movie Miss, and I'm joined by my co-host, as always, Miss Nikki Flicks. Hello, ma'am.
Hello. You hungry? I'm ready for some beans and franks. What about you?
Please, God, let there be ding-dongs.
Yes.
All right. So, April Fool's Day. Rotten Tomatoes has a critic score of 55% and an audience score of 47. So, that's why we're discussing it today. It is a turkey. However, I love every frame of this 89-minute masterpiece. And I have ever since it came out. What about you?
Absolutely agreed. This was one of the first horror movies I ever saw. And I fell in love with it and I still love it.
And I'm surprised we're discussing it as part of our Friday Fun series for the horror comedy category. And it is surprisingly good at delivering both. There's tension, there's nervousness, there's even a little bit of scare, but there's also so much humor.
It's one of the first ones that I remember having a really great mixture of both. One of the earliest movies that really got both very, very well. Like, it's a great balance.
Agreed. And what did not get a good balance in my opinion, I saw it, was the 2008 direct-to-video remake, also called April Fool's Day. I don't know if you saw that one, where they tried really hard to keep just the loose basic premise of the pranking, where people may or may not be getting killed and in peril. It was terrible. I hated it.
I know I saw it because I was very excited and nervous because I love this movie so much. And I do not remember one thing about it, which tells you everything. I remember so much about the original and I can quote it. And I've seen it so many times. The remake, I do not remember even who was in it.
I just thought I'd throw that out there in case anybody was confused as to which one we're talking about or if the remake was any good. No, don't bother, in our opinion. This one, however, was directed by Fred Walton, who had done some TV movies, and he did When a Stranger Calls with Carol Kane.
When I was watching the movie, I made a note to myself. I was like, what else did this director do? Because I'm very curious because it's fantastically shot and it's so well directed.
And the suspense.
Then in the recommended movies, when I was watching this on Amazon Prime, was When a Stranger Calls. And I went ahead and watched it because I was like, oh, they're recommending it because it's, you know, horror. I had no idea it's actually the same director. So I just rewatched Run a Stranger Calls.
And then he also, and I know because of who you are as a human, did you watch When a Stranger Calls Back, which was done years later with Carol Kane?
I absolutely adore that movie.
The feminism, how she just takes back her power. And even though the movie wasn't written well, I freaking love it.
I love it. And it delivered exactly what I expect from a sequel. It nailed that opening sequence the same way the first movie did. And I really like both movies, but I had no idea Same director. That's crazy. Okay.
So this April Fool's Day, the 86, the one we're talking about today, had a US dollar budget of about $5 million, and it only did about 13 at the box office. So tad bit of a disappointment, but I feel like we made up for it personally in our household just with VHS rentals. I think we covered it.
Exactly. I think they got their money back just with us renting this movie over and over again.
Top cast build. It's a little long, so I'm going to run through it real quick here. We've got Deborah Foreman, Deborah Goodrich, Griffin O'Neill, Thomas F. Wilson, Amy Steele, Clayton Rohner, Ken Oland, Lee Pinsent, and Jay Baker. A lot of names there that you may or may not recognize. If you look up their IMDBs, there's quite a few 80s gem actors in that bunch.
Absolutely. Yep. I definitely have my standout favorites that we'll touch on as we go. But yes. Carrying the movie, Miss Deborah Foreman absolutely knocks it out of the park. It's a hard character to play, and she's so brilliant. She can carry the whole movie in her little Prada, just prancing down the street. That woman is so fabulous, and I love her in this.
Agreed. To me, one of the standouts is our Amy Steele, who plays Kit. And again, we'll talk about her as we go. She was the final girl in Friday the 13th Part 2, and she was big in the 80s. She's the standout to me. Okay, so IMDb plot says, 9 college students staying at a friend's remote island mansion begin to fall victim to an unseen murderer over the April Fool's Day weekend, but nothing is as it seems.
Knowing the movie, they need to remove that last sentence. Take that out. You do not need to give people a taste of things aren't as they appear. Don't do that. You're going to make people too sus. They're going to get too too suspicious and think too hard and blow the surprise. They need to remove that. That's a little bit too much of a spoiler there.
I really feel like you need to send that firmly worded email to IMDb pitching why you need to write for them.
Hey, they can come to me, baby.
All right, let's dive into the plot, shall we?
Yes, let's jump into that water.
I really wanted to. This wherever they filmed this, I didn't look that part up. It's beautiful there.
Gorgeous. And I'm willing to bet a big portion of their budget went to securing this location. Probably a good chunk of it, because that is a beautiful house. It looks real. The location, the island, the ferry, all of that looks very real.
It actually reminds me a lot of from Disturbing Behavior, where it's supposed to be up here off of in the Pacific Northwest, off of Washington, like the coast somewhere.
Puget Sound area.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, they say that they're in New York later in the movie, but yeah. Okay. Anyway, sorry, I digress. Our movie opens with we hear a man holding a video camera, and he's kind of videotaping introductory confessionals from some people. We get a woman stating that she is Mary O'Reilly O'Toole O'Shea, and her friend Muffy has invited her to the island that she owns for spring break. They're waiting for the ferry to take them over there. She tells the cameraman a few made up little facts about herself that try to make her sound very puritanical. And then she ends it all by saying, and she fucks on the first date. And then she says, April Fools.
Yes, I love Deborah Goodrich. I remembered her from Just One of the Guys. Yes. And I think she's adorable and fantastic. Every single actor is perfectly cast and embodies the personality of their character. It's a great way to intro. I love this little found footage home video deal they have going, where they're introing who the different characters are, and you're just starting to kind of figure out what the relationships are between people. She's so sassy, though. She reps for the Nickies. I love when I see a good Nicky in a 80s or 90s movie.
Nickies unite.
Yep, they're usually portrayed as sassy little tarts, which is very accurate.
So as she walks away, the cameraman does call her by her name. We learn her name is Nikki. He pans over to a woman he calls Kit. She's sitting alone, and she passes on doing a video confessional. Then he pans over to Arch and Skip. Skip makes lewd gestures at the camera as Arch says he also fucks on the first date.
Oh, yes. See, for me, my favorite performance in the movie, definitely Arch Thomas F. Wilson, aka Biff from Back to the Future.
That's right. He
is fantastic. I love his humor. If you've never seen any of his stand-up, he's brilliant. He's so funny. But yeah, to me, he stands out. He's just so incredibly funny.
Then we cut to a woman organizing in a basement of her house. The housekeeper comes down and says she's leaving. And we conveniently learn that she's taking the last ferry out and there won't be another one until Monday. And I do want to point out really quick, the girl, we learn her name is Muffy. As Muffy is moving around the basement, I was paying attention because I've seen this movie a million times. She's wearing pajama bottoms that are the same. I think their budget did not go to costumes. They used all the same fabric for everybody because later in the movie, Chaz and Nikki wear the same pajama bottoms. Arch wears them under shorts at one point. It was just weird to me. I was like, oh, those pajamas are in the whole movie.
Like I said, the budget was what, 5 million, I think you said?
Yeah.
Yeah, it probably cost them $4 million to secure this location. The rest of the money got divvied up among the actors and the crew, and they all went and spent about $30 at the Goodwill to get the costumes.
I think you're right.
Or they told the actors to bring their own shit.
Yes, that happens a lot, actually.
It's so low budget, but it works in a movie like this because the low budget of it all makes it feel very real.
Grittier and more real. Yeah,
yep.
100%. So this woman is talking to herself as she's straightening up, and she mentions that this party has to be better than nice. It has to be unforgettable. So she is moving around in the basement. Like I said, she finds a small, cute little jack-in-the-box looking toy. It's white and it has little duckies on it. It's dirty because it's been sitting down there. She begins to turn the crank and we see that she's remembering a birthday party from her youth. We also get at this moment the TV movie of the week looking title card that says April Fool's Day. What did you think of that? The credits look like they are like a Lifetime movie.
Very much so. I would suspect the person who did the credits here, also the same person who did them for Jaws the Revenge. It totally looks like a Lifetime movie. Absolutely. Cheesy. But again, I swear to you, the whole budget went to the property and the rest of it, they were like, ooh, we don't have money left for the credits. What are we going to do?
They did spend some good money on music. Whoever did the music for this film, because I will say it's very effective.
That's the exact note I have. The synthesizers in the score, it sounds so cheesy in 80s, but it's really eerie and effective.
Eerie. That is a word that it goes throughout my notes constantly.
The eerie tones. Yeah, it's very well done. It's very 80s, but very well done.
Yeah, I was going to mention it at the end, but I'll mention it now. This movie, yes, very 80s time capsule. However, it holds up for what it's promising. It delivers. If you've never seen it before, you're in for a treat. You're going to get what you expect.
Absolutely. This is a movie that no one I knew growing up knew this movie other than my family. And so this was one I would always pull out and say, hey, you need to watch this movie. To horror fans, friends I made, it was always, come over, you're spending the night, we're watching April Fool's Day. What's that? Oh, you have no idea. This was the one I always wanted to show people.
Yes. And in fact, I'm going to jump in too right now and just also say, if anybody's listening to this and you usually don't care if you've seen the movie or not, and you just want to listen to us, first of all, thank you for listening. But second of all, go ahead and pause this. Go on to Amazon Prime if you have it and watch it and then come back, because this is not a movie, if you want to watch it, that you want spoiled for you.
No way.
All right. So back to the woman with the Muffy, with her little toy jack-in-the-box. She's remembering getting it for the first time as a gift at a child's birthday party. She's playing with it and all the adults, it's so weird. They're sitting around and they're very worried, like watching her intently as she opens this gift. And you're like, what's going on? We see at the end of the memory, this cute little song plays and all of a sudden this monster pops out and the child screams and all the adults bust out laughing. Cruel, but hilarious.
It just goes to show how adults being dicks to children can come back to bite people in the butt years and years later. Because as we know in hindsight, Muffy's quite the monster when it comes to enjoying scaring people. Yeah, some childhood trauma. That's definitely going to cause you to want to take things out later.
So back at the docks now, we see the ferry approaching. We meet Nan as she arrives with a lot of schoolwork-filled luggage. Kit introduces herself to Nan, and then Nikki, Arch, and Chaz, who's the guy behind the camera, introduce themselves. We learn Nikki and Chaz are indeed an item. Nan has only just met Muffy this year in drama society. and Arch is looking to hit on her. And then after hearing her talk for a minute, decides he doesn't want to hit on her, and he drops her luggage and doesn't help her.
Any lesser of an actor, you wouldn't get exactly who he is this quickly and still find him likable. And yet, Thomas F. Wilson, he's amazing, and he's being such a douche, but I just love him immediately. I'm like, I would hang out with this guy. This guy's rad.
I thought that too. I thought he's a complete douchebag, but I still would party with him. As the ferry pulls into the dock, we see Chaz go over to the kind of the first mate on the ferry here, a guy named Buck. And he says, hey man, your fly's open and your hostess Twinkie's hanging out. And then it's a prank. So he leans in and kisses him on the cheek or the forehead or something and says, April Fool. Like, who does that? Who kisses a stranger and says that?
Chaz.
It's still again, funny though.
So first of all, it just dawned on me in this last time watching it, that actor playing Chaz, is he not the boy that Terry has a crush on in Just One of the Guys?
Yes, that is Clayton Rohner. Yes.
With Deborah Goodrich. They're both in that movie together.
Yes, they are.
I bet you there's the same casting person. But yeah, that whole your hostess Twinkies hanging out. I've definitely said that a few times in my life when I see someone with their fly down. And Chaz, that him doing that to someone he doesn't know just tells you a lot about his character. This guy's got some cojones on him. He's going to just kiss a man that he does not know.
So a car comes barreling down onto the docks at the last minute, and two men pop out, Rob, Kit's boyfriend, and Harvey, who also says he has just met Muffy along like Nan, and he met her in an economics class. He says he likes to be called Hal. So do you think anybody throughout the movie is going to go ahead and call him Hal? No.
No, because he's irritating from minute one.
Springsteen, still the boss.
Skip looks at him like, are you crazy? We have to shout out here, Rob, aka Larry from Summer School. He finally woke up and he barely made it on time. I love the actor. He's great. He's in a lot of 80s classics, and I saw him on a lot of TV in the 90s. He kept working pretty regularly. Every time he popped up, though, he was always that guy from Summer School and April Fool's Day.
Right. So Muffy, Arch, Kit, Rob, Nikki, and Chaz, and Skip are all tight. We get the feeling that they all know each other for a while. They're all tight. Nan and Harvey are the newcomers. And it's interesting to watch the dynamics here in the beginning on the ferry scene, because you can tell the core group does not take nicely to newcomers. They're, especially Nikki, they're a little standoffish toward Nan and Harvey.
A little bit. And it's, yeah, it's definitely, you get the feeling that they maybe don't know Skip very well. He's introducing right. himself as Muffy's cousin. And, but obviously he and Arch are fast friends because he has a crazy sense of humor and he's open to Arch's bold personality. So they're hitting it off really well. But I have to say the whole people being standoffish to a character like Nan or a character like Hal, it's more like you're meeting these people and it's kind of like, we all get why we're friends. Why would you be a part of this? Your personality type is totally different from ours, but there's a point to it.
Yeah.
Because they're all friends with Muffy. Why did Muffy befriend Nan and Hal? Well, by the end, we know why. It's important to realize they don't seem like they'd fit into this group. Why are they even there? Because there's a master plan.
Like you said, Skip is pointed out to be Muffy's cousin. And he and Arch get along really right away, real quick. And Skip gets out a switchblade and challenges Arch to a game of stretch. I gotta ask you, just like in Jaws 3 when they play standoff in a bar, do you feel like stretch was also a made-up game for the movie? Because I've never heard of that in my life.
I really don't know. I wasn't a teenager or in my early 20s in the 80s. That didn't happen for me until quite a bit later. So I don't know if that was a normal thing, but I do know that even in the late 90s and into the early 2000s, me and my friends, we definitely found stupid and somewhat dangerous ways of amusing ourselves before there was technology everywhere. So maybe it's quite possible that you could get drunk and think that throwing a switchblade sounds like a great time.
Right. So yeah, the game stretch is they seem to be standing where one of them is holding the other one down by their feet, like pinning them, and you have to stay in that position. And they throw the switchblade down so it sticks in the wood, and they have to stretch out and try to grab it. And if they fall, they lose. Bizarre game.
It's a really weird game, but I do love that Chaz tries to pull his your flies open trick on Skip, and Skip goes, eat it. I love that. He does that. I think it happens right before they start playing Stretch. Yeah, that makes me laugh. Like, again, that just shows you his sense of humor and his personality. He fits with these people. Nan and Hal, not so much.
Yeah, and then Chaz tells Rob, he and Kit are sitting off to the side, and he tells Rob his fly is really open. And of course, because he's pulled this a couple times, he doesn't believe him, but it actually is open. Nikki strips down to a swimsuit and starts to sun herself on a different part of the ferry as Harvey shamelessly hits on her. She is not amused. He tells her he's hoping to get in good with Muffy so that he can get a job working for her dad. He's into like finance and stuff. He is such a square.
For someone who's such a square, though, he's kind of shameless and gross with how he's hitting on every female. And honestly, it's like, I get why Nikki's kind of standoffish and a bitch, because if men are treating you like that all the time, you kind of end up being standoffish toward all new people.
That's a good point.
You shouldn't be punished for being a very sexual girl. It doesn't mean that you want to be sexual with everyone, damn it. Leave her alone. Let her get a tan.
So Rob and Kit sit off to the side and they're like mildly bickering about his college career. We don't really hear what they're talking about too much. Chaz pesters Nan, who's off reading alone, and shows her that he's reading porn. He's the guy I want to hang out with. He seems like a barrel of laughs.
I love that he's like, you know, I can research it all day and I never get tired of it. And she just looks so disgusted with him.
It's so good. I know. She's so good. She reminds me of a young Glenn Close.
I can see that. To me, I'm like a Mariel Hemingway and Glenn Close had a baby. And this is her. But everything, all these little moments that we're describing, the way that all of this introduction to all the characters is scripted and shot, it's very good. The way there's these quick moments of conversation and cutaway with everything that's happening on the ferry. This is, you know, the opening moments of the movie. And I'm already thinking, who is this director? This is really well done.
Yes. And it made it did prove to be a little bit difficult trying to do my plot walkthrough here, watching it, because A, I love the movie and I get sucked in and forget to write stuff down. But B, the movie is so well directed and it moves so quickly from scene to scene. And it often cuts between two simultaneous scenes back and forth. It made it hard for me to do the plot recap, but it's worth it. It's so good. As the ferry approaches the island, Arch and Skip start to argue, and Arch says he doesn't want to play Stretch anymore. He's done. Skip tosses the knife at Arch and says, oh, come on. And Arch chucks it back and appears to stab Skip right in the stomach. He stumbles back and falls into the water. Rob and Buck jump in after him. And then Skip surfaces holding this knife belt prop and he laughs and he's like, is this what you're looking for? Ha ha ha. So he wasn't really stabbed. It was just a prank.
On the first watch, obviously you fall for this moment, but even on subsequent viewings, if it's been a few years, I don't know why, but I somehow always forget that Arch and Skip are pulling a prank on everyone together, because I'm like, wait a minute, I know who Skip really is and he doesn't really know Arch. And how is Arch in on this? I don't get it. And then like, I feel so stupid. I feel so dumb because I fall for it every time. I always forget that they're pranking as part of something bigger happening.
Yeah. Chaz says, ha ha, very funny, you guys, April Fools, but somebody could have really gotten hurt. To which Arch replies, hey, at least we don't go for that shoelace untied crap.
Right. Your barnyard door's open.
So Buck, the ferryman, first mate there, decides he's just going to stay in the water because he's already in, to go ahead and tie off the ferry when they get to the dock. As it approaches, he gets kind of sucked under and pinned between the ferry and the boards there. And he screams. He pops back up as the ferry backs away, mangled looking face, bloody, gross, an eyeball hanging out. He's screaming. The ferryman grabs him. He has blown his like whistle or whatever, like to alert the nearby constable in the boat that they need help. The constable comes flying over in his boat. They get Buck in and the ferryman takes off to get him, I guess, to the mainland, to the hospital. As they're driving off, Buck is screaming, they did it. They did this to me. So freaky. It's so fast. Everybody's screaming and upset. Like, I love this moment.
Me too. My only complaint about it is it doesn't quite track that even a professional makeup artist could have applied that appliance that quickly while in the water. But I have to let it go because it's like they've been planning this. They must have practiced and rehearsed it. It's a full piece appliance. So maybe he's just done it a several times and he can get it on lickety split. I don't know. It always bugs me just a little bit because I've seen how makeups like that get done and it can't be done in 10 seconds, honey. It just can't. Gotta let it go. It's like my only complaint. I did notice, though, now that I'm being skeptical about that, that they very quickly whisk him away and onto that boat to get him out of everyone's sight. So it kind of does still work that you're thinking this makeup doesn't look that great. They want to move him through and get him away from the kids really fast so that they don't notice that it's fake. So whatever, I'll give him a pass.
So Muffy arrives to pick everyone up and the constable tells her roughly what's happened and that he needs to borrow a boat of hers to get himself back to the mainland. Muffy tells him that they keep the spare keys to the boat in the kitchen of the house. The constable tells them all to stay put and he heads up to the house. So on the drive up, Kit tells Skip it is not his fault, but he's clearly feeling very guilty about what happened to Buck. And he randomly says, though, when they pull up to the house, nothing bad ever happens to Muffy. It was just a weird thing for him to say.
No, I get it. It's because he's meant to be a red herring. So if you think about, he's claiming that he's Muffy's cousin. He drops some nuggets of info about being kind of estranged from their family. He drops a lot of info that makes you wonder, is he maybe jealous or spiteful toward Muffy and maybe her friends? He's a red herring.
Okay. They arrive at the house and Muffy tells everyone that next month when she turns 21, she begins the first stage of her inheritance, which is the house and the island or whatever. I don't know how you inherit an island, but okay. Arch and Chaz discover that in the dining room, there are Barbie dolls dressed up like each person as their table place settings. I cannot tell you how many times I tried to make that a thing at a party when I was a teenager. I saw it in this movie.
I did it once too. I had a slumber party when I was 12 and I tried to do it to my friends and then made them watch this movie. They were all scared shitless. They loved the movie, but the Barbie doll thing didn't quite pan out.
We cut to Nikki, Muffy, and Kit in the kitchen making their pork and beans dinner, and they are bonding and laughing over a Cosmo magazine style quiz about sex. And I learned in doing a little bit of Googling that the girls were doing this on the side when they were waiting between scenes. And the director was like, let's put that in the movie. Because they were doing that already, like sitting off making each other laugh, doing these Cosmo quizzes.
That actually makes sense because my thought during this scene was this seems very natural. I have definitely sat around with a couple of girlfriends and done stuff like that and laughed and like, you know, you're like sharing personal things and everybody's kind of judging everybody else, but also trying to be, you know, like, oh, I guess I'll be honest. That's such a real moment between girlfriends and it seemed very authentic. That makes sense. It's because they saw him doing it and went, hey, let's throw that in here.
And it works, in my opinion, as well as a perfect transitional scene because somebody makes a joke right before that. I think it's Chaz is, you know, videotaping everybody. And he says, somebody's going to pull their wang tonight or something lewd like that. And then they cut to the girl squeezing a hot dog out of the package. So then after that scene in the kitchen, we cut to outside where Arch is talking to the camera. And he says, his name is Mary O'Reilly O'Toole O'Shea. And he's basically on a mission to bed as many women as possible, just not Nan.
My note for this is Thomas F. Wilson as Arch Cummings, as Mary O'Reilly O'Toole O'Shea is my favorite character in the movie, hands down. He's so funny. He reminds me of people I've known who have that very similar sense of humor. I think that's why I love him so much. I've known several people who remind me of him with his humor. He's just great. I could watch him make fun of people and pretend to be somebody else all day.
So inside, we see Harvey snooping around Muffy's father's study, where he helps himself to a cigar that he's going to enjoy later. Later, we see Skip and Nan outside on the front porch having a drink, and Skip is clearly still upset and bothered by what has happened to Buck. And he talks about just his, you know, how family and like you were saying earlier, he's not feeling real loved and appreciated in his family circle.
Exactly. This is what I was saying. He's obviously a red herring. We're meant to think that perhaps he's jealous that Muffy's going to inherit this house, and he might have reasons for wanting to hurt her and her friends.
So we cut to the dining room now, where everyone's having their pork and beans. Nan sits on a whoopee cushion, which starts the evening off nicely. Everybody's laughing and having a good time. Arch is laughing at her, and his chair, the legs snap, and he suddenly falls backwards and rolls out of his chair. I love that it's him doing it. It's not a stuntman.
Oh, no. Yeah, no. He's got that backward somersault on lock. He's perfect. Definitely practiced it a few times. It's so funny. He's good with physical comedy.
Outside, we cut to seeing a drunk Skip howling at the moon. Back in dinner, we see everybody discussing their plans for jobs and life after college. Nan makes a sweet and genuine toast that goes on a tad too long because Muffy kind of jumps on the end of it and keeps the toast going. And I like that Arch pretends like he's dozing off as they're talking. So at the end of the toast, this was weird to me, and I wanted to ask you about this, because I've watched this movie, again, as you have a million times, and I looked real close this time. When they're done toasting, they all take a drink, and it's a gag glass, so they dribble, all of them all dribble on themselves. I don't see how it's a gag glass, though, because when they zoom in on everybody holding their glasses, they just look like regular glasses. How does a dribble glass even work? Is there like a hole?
So there are two holes. There's one on either side of the mouth. When you hold the cup up and go to take a drink, as you lift the glass, the liquid hits the holes and pours out and goes all down both sides of your chin. The only thing to making it work is you have to make sure that you fill them only so much. You have to fill them under the holes so they don't start leaking ahead of time. But that is how they work. And they work perfectly. It is so funny the way they all just simultaneously have the champagne just go flying out all over their faces. I love Deborah Foreman in this scene as Muffy. When she's giving her toast, you're like, I see why everyone adores this woman. She's kind, she's smart, she's bubbly, like she's everything. She's so fantastic. And then the way she just gets this look on her face after they all spill the champagne and she says April Fool's, like, you're like, wait a minute, is there something sinister with her? Like she's enjoying this a little too much. You're so suspicious of her, but also yeah. You think she's great. Oh my God, just she's everything. I just rave and rave about her because she's so amazing in this movie.
So after dinner, Harvey is in his room putting his unmentionables away. He lights his cigar and he finds newspaper clippings in his room, in the closet and in his dresser, referring to a fiery car accident. And I don't see how Muffy is walking everybody around and she's assigning everybody their rooms. So this was intentional. I don't see how that's prankish. That just seems out and out mean and cruel to do, in my opinion, as some of these pranks tend to be. But we don't know what's happening. We don't know why he's finding this in his room. We learn that Nikki and Muffy share a past with Arch as she shows Nikki to her room. Nikki asks Muffy to stay away from Chaz. And Muffy, of course, says, you know, no problem. She's not interested in him or Harvey or rekindling anything with Arch. Muffy's done with all of them. Arch and Chaz discover that Muffy has put them in a room together, single beds, but in the same room. And then Chaz decides he doesn't want a room with Arch and he leaves to go find Nikki.
I love the moment, though, of Chaz and Arch together when they're in the room and he's like, hold me, big fella. Like, it's like, this is how guys who joke around about having the hots for each other and maybe being secretly gay, this is how they really do that without it being distasteful, offensive, hurtful, without it being like, wouldn't that be terrible if we were gay, if we had feelings for each other? I've seen men who treat each other this way, and it's a beautiful bromance, and that's all it is. That's what these two appear to have. I think maybe Arch is a little bit afraid of the fire that might be kindled, so it's good that Chaz leaves the room and decides to go sleep with Nikki, because things might take a turn if they stay in that room together much longer. They have a lot of chemistry.
So as Chaz goes on the hunt to find Nikki's room, he accidentally walks in on Harvey. He shuts the door, and as he's leaving, he hears a loud popping sound. And then we cut to Harvey, where his cigar has exploded all over his face.
He got what he deserved.
Again, like with, I just didn't spend enough time in prank and magic shops, I guess. I don't know all these things. A prop cigar like that that's meant to blow up, wouldn't that hurt?
You would think so, but my guess is there were quite a few things like that that were acceptable 30, 40 years ago that nowadays it's like, no, 8-year-olds would be playing around with that stuff and someone's going to get hurt. Back then though, all bets were off. They didn't even make kids wear seatbelts.
So
speaking of the pranks in people's rooms though, you kind of touched on it with the stuff about a fiery car accident. This is what I'm talking about, where in hindsight, I realize it's all just brilliant way to give you these red herring moments. Like, this is not a prank. This is not a silly, funny April Fool's Day joke. Someone's being really mean. Mm-hmm. And that's the point. You have to make them genuinely feel like they are in danger. And how do you do that? You need to cross the line. So it's a little shitty that that's being done, but that's what makes them afraid. You have to do something to make them scared.
So Nikki gets sprayed by a broken sink in her room, which is a funny, harmless prank. As she changes her shirt, she finds in her dresser a very heavy-duty set of cuffs on a chain, like S&M-looking stuff. And again, prankish in her dresser for her to find. I don't understand. I'm just going to say this. I don't understand. She doesn't seem like a prude. She seems like she's totally into that stuff. So why would that be bothersome to find that in your dresser if you're into that lifestyle?
I don't know. We did see with the girls that they were, you know, taking their little Cosmo quiz and talking about stuff. It seemed like this isn't something they talk about all the time. And it seemed like Muffy and Kit are perhaps not quite as experienced or open about these things. So maybe they just don't know that. That's about her. I don't know. I'm not really terribly sure, but I feel like there could possibly have been more backstory to some of that stuff that should make you understand what's going on with it, but then it's just not there. I don't know.
So Arch finds some illegal drug paraphernalia for drug use in his medicine cabinet in his room, which he does not find amusing. So then he decides he's going to relax. He grabs a porn movie out of his stash of porn that he brought, and he heads out of his room. He grabs the doorknob, and it comes right off the door. I do like that prank. Those make me laugh. Rob and Kit in their room find a painting that has the eye holes cut out, and they can see eyes moving behind the painting. They lift it up and find a really cool Felix the Cat clock, where the eyes and the tail move back and forth. I still to this day want that clock.
I've seen one. They're really cute. Right? But yeah, at night in your room, that would be creepy as hell. This is one of my favorite moments in the entire movie, what their gag is here.
So they get into bed and they discover, as Rob's turning off the light next to the bed, that all of the lights in their room are wired together. So when you turn one off, another one somewhere in the room goes on. So he gets up and he turns that one off, and then another one goes on. So I like that actually in this bit, it's funny because Kit is sitting there laughing. She thinks it's hilarious, as we do. So Rob decides to just unscrew the bulb in the one next to the bed because that'll, you know, stop the chain.
And then as soon as they think they're done because he unscrewed the light bulb, the damn cat lights up and she just loses her shit and starts laughing. It seems very natural. You almost wonder if they told them, we're not going to tell you what's going on, just get in bed and turn off that light, and then recorded what was happening, just filmed it, because it seems very natural, almost like they're surprised by it.
Yeah, agreed. Then we have Nan getting out of the shower in her room to the sounds of a crying baby. She goes over to the closet and finds an old cassette player with a little cassette of a baby crying. Cut to Arch catching Muffy going into her room, and he hits on her, but she shoots him down. And then I was thinking, Nikki and Chaz are an item. Muffy isn't going to go there again, and you don't want Nan. Kit and Rob are an item. You're out of options. I don't think he was smart in shooting the Nan option down so fast.
If all he's after is getting laid, he pretty much has sized her up that's not the kind of girl that is, so why bother? And I actually kind of appreciate that, because a lesser man would go hit on anything female at this point. And at least he's like, you know what? She's not that kind of girl. I'm not going to bother. I'm not going to waste her time or mine. So yeah, maybe Arch is a little more highly evolved than we thought. I don't know.
So he wanders the halls now, trying various doors. I don't know why, because like I just said, there's nobody left to go find. He opens the door to Nikki and Chaz. Well, Nikki's room, but Chaz is in there. they are in a crazy position having sex. You only see it for a second, but there's legs everywhere. He just backs right out of the room. Doesn't even say anything.
My thought on that is, I think maybe he's not sure which room is his because there's a lot of doors. So he's just like, which room is mine? I don't even remember. He's feeling so dejected. But yes, when he walks in and sees them, the only thing I could think of was that does not look enjoyable or comfortable at all. That doesn't look like fun. And honestly, neither of them look like they're having fun doing that either. So I don't know what those two are up to, but they should be taking some of the toys and masks and shit that they found and rolling with that stuff instead of trying right. These bizarre, you know, yoga positions.
So Arch goes back to his room and grabs himself a magazine out of his porno stack. And he sits back in his chair, and just as he's going to relax and flip open that magazine, the legs collapse and he falls backwards and rolls out of his chair.
That makes me laugh every time because I forget that it's going to happen again.
So outside, we see a very drunk Skip going into the boathouse. It's dark. He's alone. And we quickly find out that maybe he's not totally alone. We get an awesome jump scare with a cat. I want to know where the cat is for the rest of this movie. Was this Muffy's cat? Why did we ever see this cat again?
I don't think it's her cat. I think her cat isn't her cat. It's just a cat. And I think it's just wandering the island. I've seen cats used to elicit jump scares so many times. This one works very well. Again, whoever the director is, fantastic job. They shot that very well. The whole sequence with Skip in this little boathouse is very unsettling.
And one thing that lends to that is the music. It's very effectively used. So he gets grabbed from behind. We don't see who grabs him. End of scene. So the next morning, Rob and Kit startle Muffy, who's in the kitchen looking very disheveled, cooking some eggs. She quickly excuses herself, saying she knows that she must look a mess, and she bumps into Arch on the way up the stairs and out of the kitchen. Nan sits on the porch outside studying as Rob and Kit head off for the lake. Arch, Chaz, Nikki, and Harvey play soccer in the yard. Arch asks if anybody has seen Skip. This is where I noticed again, everybody wearing pajama pants material. It's just a weird thing that jumps out at me. I hate to keep bringing it up.
I have to say, when it comes to the pajama pants that keep making their way around, among my circle of friends that I used to hang out with all the time, there were articles of clothing that traveled around the group. There were like sweatshirts where someone would be like, oh yeah, you know, my old PBR sweatshirt that I've had for 10 years. And who has it? Oh, I think this person's had it for like the last 2 years now. Oh, and then they gave it to somebody else. I've seen clothing items that get passed around and shared and it becomes a joke. So maybe that's the tea. Maybe that's what's happening. But in this scene, forget about the pajama pants on Chaz, because I have to talk about what the hell is Arch wearing? These shorts. He's got these little denim shorts on, and it looks like there's some kind of little girly biker shorts or something sticking out the bottom of them.
They're like the pajama pants material pattern, if you look at them closely. That's why I was like, what the hell did the costume person do here?
It's like they wanted to put him in hot pants, and then they went, those are too short and revealing. What can we do? We're going to create some cutoffs out of this pajama pants that we have like 10 pairs of. And then you can put those on under the jean shorts. I don't know. It's all a very strange choice. I can't help but laugh at it every time because your eye goes to his legs because he has some kind of knee brace on. He has a bad knee. But then you notice like, what the fuck is he wearing? What are those shorts? What the hell? He's got some nice legs on him. Yeah, running around showing off those legs. I guess I'd wear shorts like that too.
So Nan, who is clearly still upset about what she found in her room, looks over and sees Muffy wandering around down by a nearby shed or guest house of sorts, and she takes off to go look for her. We cut to Rob and Kit at the boathouse making out when they see Skip float past underneath the floorboards and he's not moving. So they freak out and they run back to tell everyone what just happened, what they saw. And everyone except Muffy and Nan take off to search for Skip. The guys find Skip's switchblade at the docks, broken and bloody, and they wonder if the ferryman is behind it because of what happened with Buck. Back at the house, Muffy, who looks noticeably different than she did from the day before, is confronted by Nan, who asks how she found out about it, and we see Harvey eavesdropping in the hall. They never come out and say in this setup here what exactly is happening and who this, you know, what's, but we can assume at this point, the baby crying, she says, how'd you find out? Was it one of his friends? I'm assuming she had an abortion.
I think it's all just, it's assumed she got pregnant, had an abortion. Okay. And yeah, she clearly instantly thinks that's what this is about and instantly thinks Muffy is being very cruel doing this to her and doesn't know how she would even have found out about it.
I thought maybe it was Harvey because she goes from one of his preppy friends and then you see him eavesdropping and looking kind of sad in the hall. And I was like, that's never said.
Yeah, I don't think he has anything to do with it other than he's eavesdropping on this conversation and is getting a lot of information from hearing it and like, oh, that sounds kind of ugly. What's going down between those two? I think she's just talking about whatever some random guy that Muffy maybe knows or something.
So we cut to abruptly Arch out in the woods searching for Skip. He gets snagged up in a rope trap that pulls him up off the ground by his leg and he's dangling there swinging. And we see a rattlesnake snapping at him. A pair of men's boots approach and kick the snake out of the way. And then we see that Arch looks up at this person and he gets very afraid. He looks scared. We see Nan sitting alone on a bench, crying somewhere outside. Eerie music plays, which is so effective, and the wind starts to blow, and then we cut away.
It's well shot, and the music's great. Those are like the two technical things this movie really has going for it.
So we cut to Rob and Chaz arriving back at the house where Kit and Nikki tell Muffy they need to call the police. Muffy tells them just call the constable at his home and gives them the number, and then she decides she's going to make everyone some tea. In the kitchen, Kit tells Muffy they can't get through to the mainland, let alone to the constable. They find out the water line in the kitchen isn't working because mud starts to come out of the sink.
So gross.
So Nikki and Harvey volunteer to go over to the well on the property and get some water. Muffy says to Kit that she's not worried about Skip and Art. They're probably playing some kind of stupid trick. She says it kind of weird like that. She says Art instead of Arch. So you're kind of like, what's going on with Muffy? She's being really weird.
In hindsight, of course, you know this is the transition from Muffy to Buffy. The way that she's dressing different, looks different. She's behaving so strangely. She's talking weird. I love the fact that Deborah Foreman as an actress is playing Muffy, who is a method actress pretending to be her non-existent twin sister Buffy, and she's doing that. And even in moments where you're seeing Buffy alone, like right before Nan walks in to talk to her, she's so method in the character. Muffy is so method that she's like all in on everything I'm doing, touching. I'm Buffy pretending to be Muffy. Just how complex acting that out is. And then to see the way that Kit is responding to her in this scene, you're like, oh, we are definitely right, because her good friend here is picking up that something's really off. I feel like something's really off with her too. This is really strange. Like, it just, I love the interaction between the two of them during that scene, because you can see how uncomfortable Kit is getting with her.
Yes.
And you only had just a handful of scenes with Muffy to establish what that character is so that you could see the difference when she's not Muffy anymore.
That's true.
You have to have that established. And then the only way that works, like you said, is if the other actors, the other characters are feeling uncomfortable around her, and we have to notice that. So kudos to the actress that plays Kit. She's so great. And she's totally letting us feel what we're supposed to feel, which is very suspicious of Muffy right now.
Yes. So at the well, Harvey hits on Nikki, which slime ball. Because she's with Chaz. He's been talking about how he wants to hook up with Muffy so he can get a good job. Like, he's just a slime ball.
He tells her he wants to plow her field. But then he's not even man enough to be the one to climb down into the well.
Yeah, she drops the flashlight after he drops the bucket. And then she's the one that has to go down after it because there are little rungs leading down the side of the inside of the well. And I like how she says, I'm not afraid of a few spiders and frogs. I'm a big girl. It's like, yeah, but do you really want it? I don't care if you boil it. I'm not drinking that water. That
right, well, that's water. Gross. Ugh.
Thank you. So as she climbs in, she falls when one of the rungs comes loose off the wall. She begins screaming and then Arch's head, Skip's head, and Nan's full body all float up in the water around her.
Mm-hmm.
First time viewing. And then, like you said, after a few years and you forget stuff, every time it gets me when I forget.
The props are really well done. The heads look very much like the actors. Whoever did those did a really good job, especially the one of Arch. It looks exactly like him. And of course, that is Nan, who met Muffy through drama. Yeah, I'll pretend to be a dead body in the well. Sure. I don't even know these people. Now we know why Nan's there.
So back at the house, Kit, Nikki, Chaz, Rob, and Harvey all discuss how they think this is all because of what happened to Buck on the ferry. Harvey asks Muffy where she keeps her guns, to which she replies, they don't keep guns in the house. Next, Rob answers a phone call, an incoming phone call from Constable Potter, who we see while talking to Rob is standing in a hospital. The constable says it's not Buck. He's been there all day in the hospital with him and the ferryman. So it's not them doing, you know, whatever's happening. Rob hangs up and tells everybody the constable said that they all need to stay together. And when he gets there, he's going to send up a flare and they can all go out down to the docks together. Everyone proceeds to lock the house up and Kit goes into the study and she notices a photo on the desk of two small children who look very similar, almost like twins. She gets interrupted by Muffy acting very weird.
I love the escalation of the weirdness. It's a slow progression, but every time you see her, it's getting worse. Whatever's wrong with this girl, it's getting worse and it's obviously happening, but you still believe it. The first time viewing, you do not figure out exactly what the real tea is. You're just going with it and believing everything she's doing.
Yeah. And following along with Kit, who is our final girl, and everything she's seeing, and we're getting the reaction from her, and we're like, oh, we should be suspicious, because she's suspicious. Like, yeah. So we cut to Harvey getting a gun, a little revolver, it looks like, out of his suitcase and tucking it into his pants. Back downstairs, we have Chaz, Harvey, Nikki, and Kit all talking about how odd Muffy has been acting all day. Harvey tells them that he overheard Muffy and Nan arguing earlier in the kitchen about something that Nan found in her room, something about an abortion. So then that's where we get the confirmation that that indeed was what that prank was about. Nikki is sitting on the couch downstairs in this living room. She just pulls out from behind the cushion some of these S&M leather strappy looking things. And she goes, yeah, I found this in my room. My question was, you're so traumatized from what happened in the well and you're sitting in the living room with everybody. When did you have time to go up to your room and bring down these leather straps? They're just sitting on the couch.
Who knows?
But she says, yeah, this is what I found in my room and I don't think it's funny. Chaz and Harvey argue about the car accident newspaper clippings from his room. And then Rob enters, followed by Muffy, who says, she's going to go upstairs to her room, even though they're all supposed to stay together. Chaz and Nikki go ahead and excuse themselves up to their room and say that they'll be fine because they're going to stay together. Rob and Kit go up to the attic. They say because they want to be able to see the constable's flare better. Harvey says, no problem. I'll keep watch on the stairs. He's feeling safe because as we saw, he's got that gun tucked away. So Nikki's in her room, hysterical about what's happened and wants to just get the hell out of Dodge. Can't say I blame her. She's packing her bag. Chaz is trying to calm her down. He puts on one of those little funny S&M style masks with the no eye holes. And he lays down on the bed and he's taunting her like, let's just have some fun. You need to calm down.
I think his exact words when he put one of those on was that he is the Birdman of bondage. I don't know why it makes me laugh, but it does when he puts that on. And of course, her reaction, that's exactly how I'd be behaving. I'd be like, you know what? Screw you. I'm not going to laugh. You're not going to calm me down. And we're certainly not going to be into any of that right now. No. She makes the cardinal mistake of leaving him alone. They were supposed to stay together.
Yes. And then when she returns to the room, Chaz is lying there motionless with his hands cupped over his junk. He's still dressed. She jokes as she's putting on her shoes that this isn't show and tell, and she tells him to put it away, and she slaps his hands off to expose a pool of blood where his penis should be.
Chaz lost his hostess Twinkie.
So she backs away from the bed. She turns around and gasps as she sees somebody stepping out of the closet to surprise her.
All I can say is thank goodness someone was there. Obviously, we're talking about the movie as if you have definitely already seen it. Thank goodness the killer, quote unquote, was right there, because if I'm Chaz, I wouldn't have wanted Nikki for more than 2 seconds to think this was real, to think that he's really injured or dead. I'd be like, you know what? I'll lay there and play dead for a second, but that better not go on for more than that, because I do not want her to really think something's wrong with me.
Traumatizer, yeah.
Yeah, like it's over the line, a lot of this stuff. You're traumatizing these poor people. I'm willing to bet after this, they all said, Muffy, that was great. Yeah, see ya.
I know, and do you think they all stayed friends after this?
I highly doubt it, because a lot of the shit she's doing to these people, it feels very invasive and it feels like it's over the line. But as we saw what happened to her in her childhood, she's kind of a bitch.
So meanwhile, in the attic, Rob tells Kit that on the phone before, when he was talking to the constable, he told him not to trust Muffy. Then they find all of the dolls from that dinner party scene displayed on the floor. In little gruesome death scenes, they find two heads and a nan floating in a bowl of water, which I thought was so funny to go that extra step and have the actual bowl of water, like the well.
Yep.
We see two Barbies that are supposed to be Chaz and Nikki lying on a bed covered in blood. Then the constable shoots the flare outside, prompting Rob and Kit to run out now looking for Nikki, Chaz, and Harvey. They run into Nikki's room. They find blood all over on the bed. We see it dripping on the floor, but we don't actually see anything, no bodies or anything horrific. We just assume, because of seeing the dolls a minute ago, that they've been hacked up and there's blood everywhere. So Kit and Rob are upset by that. They back out of that room and they continue on the hunt. They go into Muffy's room where they find Harvey swinging from the rafters, hogtied and hung. And I wanted to mention, during all of this, the suspenseful music when Kit is searching each room, they're looking for Nikki and everything. Doesn't go on too long. A lot of movies where they try to build the suspense, the scenes just go on a bit too long. I think it's perfect in this movie. And then the music adds to it.
Agreed. The pacing is just right. It strikes me now, having seen it so many times, and the only people who were willing to be like, yeah, you can stage my death and I'll play dead and scare the shit out of people. Chaz, who only did it for about 2 seconds, and then Nan and Hal, the ones who don't know everybody and don't care about traumatizing them. They're not friends.
Oh my God, I just thought about that. That's a great point.
Hal and Nan are the only two that were willing to play dead for a significant period of time and scare the bejesus out of people. They're the only ones.
They show you that Harvey, that's really him hanging there.
Both he and Nan, it's like, why are they here? Now we get it. Now we know why Muffy befriended them and invited them to this gig, because she wanted some people who don't know everybody that well, who would play dead.
That's so right. It all tracks.
Exactly. But again, it all kind of goes back to Muffy is a stone cold bitch. She's kind of terrible. She's really likable and great, but she's kind of terrible for doing this to people and for dragging these unsuspecting people into all this crap too. Like, Muffy, get out of here with your trauma and your bullshit.
So Rob and Kit bolt out of the house and down to the docks to find a deserted boat. In the boat, they realize that there are no keys, which I thought was weird because he just pulled up and why wouldn't you just leave the keys in the boat? But apparently the constable did not. They find a letter on the seat and it says basically it's from the state hospital saying that Miss St. John has been a patient there for the last 3 years. She has recently escaped and is believed to be returning to her family home. She is unstable and dangerous and they should be on the lookout. Kit mentions that Muffy has been at college for the last 3 years, so it can't be her that they're talking about when they say Miss St. John. Then she mentions to Rob that she saw a picture of twins in the study. So
putting all the pieces together.
Piecing it together.
She's such a smart cookie. I gotta say, what you mentioned about the boat, like, why aren't the keys there? because the constable's not the constable, he's an actor and he's in on it, or no, he's her uncle or something like that, but he's in on it.
Yeah, but at the moment we don't know that's what's happening.
But it has to make sense in hindsight, and that's what I love about movies that are really complicated or pull some kind of trick on you, and if you go back and watch it, everything still tracks. That makes sense. You're like, okay, why are they finding this file on the boat but the keys aren't there? Well, because he staged it. He brought the boat in, left the paperwork there for them to find, but took the keys so they can't use the boat, because there's a plan in motion here. Everything he did is to make everything work the way Muffy wants it to.
All right, quit making sense.
The movie has to make sense, or else when you have the big reveal, you'd be like, wait a minute, I call bullshit. There was a bunch of stuff that didn't go with that. It has to all line up in hindsight, and it does, and I love that.
Also, you're kind of saying this movie needs a rewatch, because once you've watched it for the first time and everything plays out, and then you go back and watch it again, it's even better.
Yes, because when you know what's really going on, you can go back and watch it and be like, I've got my eye on you, movie. I know what the real truth is, and I'm going to make sure that you didn't fuck it up. I love to rewatch a movie like this and be like, I'm watching, and everything still tracks. Everything still makes sense. I love that.
Rob and Kit head back up to the house because they realize they need to grab the keys out of the kitchen for the boat. They see that all of the doors have now been shut and all the windows are shut, so they have to find an open window to the basement, and that's where they decide to go in. They see a blood trail, which leads them to the painting that had been in their room before with the eye holes cut out. Kit identifies Muffy's burned clothes in the furnace, and then when they pull that painting away from the wall, they realize that the eyes behind it... Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Before we get there, they see on the wall Muffy and Buffy written side by side with height measurements marked out on the wall. And they're putting two and two together that Muffy and Buffy are twins. Buffy must be the one that escaped from the hospital. She has burned Muffy's clothes. Something weird's going on. Then they pull away the painting and Muffy's decapitated head falls into their lap. Muffy, who's pretending to be Buffy, slams the window shut to the basement, nails it shut, so they have nowhere to go except up back into the house. And I thought that was such a good touch, because this scene freaks me out every time.
Mm-hmm.
So Rob and Kit have to run upstairs to the kitchen. They start frantically looking for the boat keys. And then Buffy bursts into the kitchen from outside holding a giant knife as Rob accidentally gets locked into the pantry when he goes in for the boat key. Buffy backs Kit into the dining room as Rob is screaming hysterically from inside the pantry. And I love that he just keeps yelling her name. Kit, Kit. He's going, I love you.
He's in full-blown tears, full-blown dramatics. I love that it's kind of a role reversal here, where the man is the one locked up screaming for help and the woman is the one confronting the killer. And he's just, I love you, Kit. No, I love you. Like, it's so funny and he plays it so well.
Oh, he's right up there with David Arquette as a scream queen, because he screams for like 8 minutes straight.
Yes. And I have to point out, how lucky is Muffy here? She's playing a very risky game. They believe that Muffy is dead, and this is her psychotic twin sister who has murdered their friend,
Buffy.
They could hurt her very badly.
Oh, yeah.
She's playing a real risky game. Now we understand why she says they don't keep guns in the house.
Good thing.
And why it was so scary that Hal had one. Bitch could get shot.
Oh, it's true. It's true. But that's why I'm calling her Buffy, because she's still in character.
Oh, yes. She's still very much so, Buffy, stalking the hell out of Kit with that knife. And when she jumps up on the table like a damn animal.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I'm living for it. Like, she's so scary.
So Kit's begging for her to stop. And she backs her into the dining room, jumps on the table. Like you said, Kit has nowhere to go except to turn around. And there's this set of giant sliding doors that lead into the living room. So just as she's backed up against those doors, Buffy jumps at her and stabs the doors with her knife, and Kit turns around and goes falling into the living room. The music in this scene, right before she turns and goes into the living room, is so tense. Even though I know what's going to happen and I know it's not real, it's so tense.
Mm-hmm.
So Kit bursts into the living room where she sees Chaz, Nikki, Skip, Arch, Harvey, Nan hanging out. Kit looks back at Buffy, who comes in the room smiling, holding up her knife, showing that it's fake by pushing the retractable end against her other hand, and Kit reacts appropriately. She's angry, and she says, oh, ha ha, really funny, you guys, fuck you. And they all bust out laughing.
Oh my God, the look on her face. She is livid. She's wishing that knife was real so she could cut a bitch right now. I feel you, Kit. I would react the same way if somebody thought this was funny and did this to me. And I love the quick cut from that moment to poor Rob still in that pantry, yes, still crying and screaming, I love you, Kit. Oh my God. Now that you know what's going on, when you see him in there, you're like, that poor schmuck.
And then this is where Buck is. He steps up from the shadows from behind and taps Rob on the shoulder and scares the shit out of him. He grabs that latexy mangled bloody eye and peels off off of his face. And I love that Rob is still yelling, I love you, to Kit. So Buck says, I love you too, babe. And he kisses him on the neck and then slaps the latex thing right on his face, lets him out of the pantry. And Rob just goes running around to the living room and he runs in screaming and he's got that thing stuck hanging off his face.
Not before Rob takes a good swing at Buck. I noticed when he did, I swear to you, the actor, he missed, obviously, but he punched that wall. Go back and watch that. He punched that wall really hard. And when he screamed, it's because he was in pain. He accidentally missed and hit that wall really, really hard. And then, yeah, when he goes running out with that thing hanging off his face, oh my God. If I was Kit, I would probably, like, that would be the breaking point, and I would go ahead and start laughing because the sight of that is so good. It's so funny.
Oh, it has everybody in hysterics, and they all at once stop and look at them, and they go, April Fools! It's so good.
Imagine if you're Kit and Rob right now thinking this whole thing, everyone has been on it from minute one and they all thought this would be a great way to pull an April Fool's on you. Yeah, I would want to kill all my friends.
So after taking a minute to decompress, Muffy explains this was all a trial run for an idea that she has to keep her house an inheritance. She wants to host, turn it into a country inn and host weekend getaways with a murder mystery twist. So we find out that only the ferryman and Buck and Constable Potter, who is actually her Uncle Frank, are all in on it. Muffy does have a twin, but it's not Buffy. It's actually Skip.
And for a second there, you're thinking, wait a minute. He was the first victim. How does that? And then you realize he was told pretend to be the cousin and then pull the whole gag, you know, with the knife and all that. But that's all he knew. He right. didn't know the rest of what was going to happen. So he wasn't really in on it, even though he did lie.
True. So Rob points out that was a big risky game she did because she could have gotten herself killed.
Exactly. And at least she has the wherewithal to explain, you're right, and I actually almost did.
With Harvey, yeah.
Exactly.
And then she kind of apologizes to Arch and says, you know, who could have known about the snake in the woods? Sorry, buddy. Again, risky the whole fucking weekend because there are a lot of unknown variables in this equation that she's doing.
Exactly. That's why I'm saying this bitch is not a very good friend because this was her little trial run to find out what would and wouldn't work. And boy, did she go hard on her poor unsuspecting friends.
Especially when she turns around and says, now, of course, when I open it up to the public paying guests, they're going to know what they're in for. And the scenarios will be far less extreme. Well, then why did you do this one? If you're not going to be this extreme, why even do it?
Because she has a mean streak. It's all her childhood trauma from that damn Jack in the Box, I tell you. She has kind of a mean streak, and she poked at a lot of sore spots with her so-called friends. Not very nice. She's not a very good friend.
So after the bizarre passive-aggressive apologies that she kind of gives to everybody.
That's how I would characterize them. It specifically, you know, she's like, some of the clues in the rooms were taken too seriously. That's
and
what she says.
Sorry. Yeah.
They were taken too seriously. Excuse me. No, you planted things that were a little too personal and mean-spirited.
Super passive aggressive apology.
Yeah, passive aggressive. Yeah. Boy, oh boy, she's kind of a bitch. And I don't like that they're just going to be like, haha, whatever, we're all friends, and start partying. I kind of want to see Muffy get what's coming to her a little bit.
Agreed. So yeah, they pour the champagne. It starts a flowing. Everyone's going to, you know, turn on the music and start partying.
I love that they're playing with Muffy's decapitated head.
Yes. And Buck tosses Arch's decapitated head to him. Arch comments that when he was out in the woods, he nearly crapped his pants because he was so scared. And the ferryman interjects, "What do you mean nearly? I was there." So good.
Yep. And then someone's like, "This should be out of the dryer soon." I love the sight of Arch holding his own decapitated head, though, because then you can really see one next to the other, how much that really looks like him. Like, such a good job.
Yeah, but it did ruin it for me because of that. When your Buck is tossing him the head and explaining to him, I was able to do up these props, redress old props, thanks to Muffy's photos. It's like, that's not somebody else's face you redress. That looks exactly like him.
Yeah, that they made a mold of the actors' faces, clearly.
Clearly. Like,
come on now.
So music's playing, alcohol's flowing, everyone's acting rambunctious, having a good time, except for Nan and the ferryman. They're sitting off in the corner quietly sipping their drinks. I thought that was funny. True to character. She's not amused.
I wouldn't be either. I'd be really, really upset and pissed off.
So as the party winds down, then we see Muffy making her way up to her room, obviously drunk or very tipsy. She finds a wrapped gift sitting on her bed. It's just a plain white jack-in-the-box type toy. She sits down on the edge of her bed and starts turning the crank. And then when she gets to the end of the music, before she lets it pop open, she hesitates. Obviously, the flashback to the traumatic childhood jack-in-the-box experience. So then she decides, okay, I'm going to go ahead and do it. Just as she's turning the crank and the lid starts to pop open, Nan jumps up from behind her and slides a knife across her neck. Muffy's screaming, blood squirting everywhere. And then it takes her a second to realize that it wasn't real. Nan leans forward and smiles at Muffy and shows her it's a fake knife. And she's kind of smirking. And Nan says, "April Fools," and kisses Muffy on the cheek. I love this moment because it kind of is full payback on Muffy.
Muffy deserves it. The only bad thing about this is that everyone else doesn't get to see it happen, because I'm sure they all wanted to watch this happen to see Muffy get what she deserves. I freaking love the way this movie ends. Oh my God. It's one of my favorite endings to a horror movie ever.
Well, also, because of everything that happened with Nan, and you get the feeling that the pranks were cruel, you see her being not amused and calm all the way to the end. This tracks. Like, you feel like she might really kill her.
For a split second, you're thinking she might. Maybe Muffy read things wrong and picked on the wrong person.
Exactly. But then when you realize it's fake, you know, it's still good, though, because Muffy bought it. And then it shows us the final shot of the film, which is that cute little clown that popped out of the jack-in-the-box. It wasn't a monster. It was just a little clown. And it zooms in as it closes its eye and winks at us. Fade to black, cue the music and the credits, the end.
The music. Can we talk about the song? When I used to watch this movie, we used to let the credits play because we loved the song so much. We used to dance around to it. I don't know why. There's something about that ridiculously jovial tune, and the lyrics always made us laugh really hard. Talking about too bad you're crazy, too bad you're
too
all
bad
your marbles are gone.
Loony as hell.
Exactly. Too bad you're wacko. It's so funny.
Like, it's like Buffy's theme song. Yeah.
Perfectly fits the movie. And I just remember we used to let the credits play. Sometimes we'd rewind it and play it again because we just loved this song so much. I know this is one of those moments where you're going to tell me that we're idiots, but I loved this song and I don't know why. Me and my little baby sis, we just loved it.
I think it's funny and awesome. And yeah, when I call you an idiot, it's in the most loving way possible.
When I say bite in the ass, I mean that in the nicest possible way.
I have my idiot things too. Trust me.
Rambo farting and the effect that has had on you forever.
To this day.
Oh, Rambo.
All right. So let's jump to the end of the podcast here, where I like to ask you three questions.
All right.
Question number one, have you ever gone to a B&B whodunit weekend like this? And if so, or if not, would you like to?
I would never go to one. I never have, and I never would. Way more likely that I would be an actor in one, which I've been an actor in haunted houses and things like that. So I could see myself working in one for sure, but I would never want to go to one. It's kind of like going to haunted houses is a little bit ruined for me because you've been a part of it and you are looking at it and going, oh my God, your makeup's fantastic. Or, oh girl, stop banging on that wall. It's going to fall over. It's kind of ruins the effect.
You've had a peek behind the mask, as it were.
Exactly. I've been behind the mask. I don't think I would be into it. I would be thinking about what the actors are doing as actors. I could be one though. I think it would be a fun job.
So I shouldn't invite you to my next murder mystery dinner party then? Is that what you're saying?
Not unless you want me to star in it, baby.
All right. Question two. Do you think Muffy's idea worked and did she get to keep her inheritance?
I'm guessing that it does because she seems like a really smart cookie and she's a fabulous actress. So she probably tweaked and morphed it into something that would work for the general public. And she's charming as all hell and that house is beautiful. So I don't see why she wouldn't have made a great hostess and it wouldn't have worked out just fine for her. Nothing bad ever happens to Muffy. Poor Skip. I want to know where Skip is, where her twin is. That's what I want to know.
Right? What did he ever do? Okay, so question three. We're going to play two rounds of marry, fuck, kill. Round one, Chaz, Arch, and Rob.
I would marry Arch. I would fuck Chaz and kill Rob.
Okay.
Sorry about it. Rob's a doll, but he's boring as all get out. I can't be married to a man that boring. It's going to be Arch for me. Chaz is cute. I would bed him. I'm looking to bed as many. No, I'm just kidding.
So I answered sort of similar. I say fuck Chaz for sure. Because also he just seems like he's into the kinky stuff and would have fun with it. He wouldn't be boring, right? And then marry Rob because I want that stable guy who's on a medical career path. And kill Arch. Yeah, he can go. All right, round two. Marry, fuck, kill. Skip, Harvey, and Buck. I know, it's harder. It's harder.
So I would marry Buck. He's a really good looking guy without that makeup on. He's very talented. Yeah, I could marry that dude. So I would definitely fuck Skip. He's cute, but I wouldn't want to be around him for very long. He seems like he's kind of a mess and has issues. And I would definitely kill Harvey because that guy's just a walking cliche and he needs to go.
Okay, so I had the same exact answers.
There you go.
All right, so anyone interested in watching April Fool's Day, it is currently on Amazon Prime, or you can do like us and own a copy because it's that fabulous, folks. You need to watch it more than once to truly appreciate it.
Agreed.
So on that note, we want to thank everyone for listening as always. And I want to thank my co-host Nikki Flicks for joining me.
Thank you. It's one of my favorites. This was an easy conversation to have.
All right, we'll see you all later. Goodbye.
Bye.
Hey, listeners, Movie Miss here, saying we know you have a lot of options when it comes to podcasts, so we want to thank you so much for listening to ours. Please make sure to find us on our socials and join us. Be part of our bad movie conversations. We want to chat with you. We're on Facebook with an official page, as well as a Let's Talk Turkeys discussion group, where you can talk with other like-minded individuals who like bad movies. We're on Instagram at Let's Talk Turkeys. Our Twitter handle is at Gobble Podcast. That's GOBBLEPODCAST. And of course, you can always email us direct. We would love to get suggestions from you of movies you would like us to cover. If you want to be a guest on the show, we would love that. So directly, that's Let's Talk Turkeys, all one word, at yahoo.com.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.